Our God is wise. That is to say, his work is not haphazard. The gospel is not an afterthought when God's plan for the world somehow went in the wrong direction. The world was created for the gospel, to be an arena in which God will show forth his glory. And therefore, everything that has to do with the gospel has to do in one way or another, probably in more ways than one, with an essential aspect of the gospel, an aspect I'd like to point out to you this morning. The church is not an afterthought. The church has an important role in God's outworking of the gospel. It is to exemplify the gospel in very concrete manners, more than one. Look with me at Ephesians chapter 1. In the interests of time, I shan't read it, but I'd like to go through some of this portion with you and point out a number of ideas that are so much part of this chapter. God is blessed by the apostle for having blessed those whom he describes in verse 3 as us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ. Now, Paul uses the word us in two different ways in this chapter. This us is inclusive. And he's telling us that the blessings that we have all have to do with Christ. They're all to be found in him, in Christ. And they have as their source none other but God himself. In verse 4, he tells us that we were chosen in him, in Christ, one of those many blessings, before the foundation of the world. Once again, indicating what I prefaced by saying that God had the gospel in view before the world was made. He describes the purpose for which we were chosen in Christ. And this gives us some indication of Paul's eschatology. We were chosen in him to be holy and blameless before him. In other words, the grounds of our election were not that God foresaw that we would be, or that in fact we were in some way, but we were chosen in order to. The gospel is the means by which God is going to make us holy and without blame before him. Paul goes on to tell us something of our need when he speaks of our redemption through the blood of Christ, the forgiveness of our trespasses, indicating something of our state, contrary to what we will yet be, holy and blameless before him. And he tells us that the measure of the forgiveness which we have is the measure of the riches of God's grace. How does one measure the immeasurable? How does one evaluate something that is beyond all imaginable value? I find a little intimation like this tremendously encouraging, because as I struggle to be reminded that the forgiveness that Christ has purchased for me is such that it is according to the riches of God's grace, means that I could never sin beyond his reach. And that someday, in spite of what I am today, I shall be holy and without blame before Him. Because that too is a work of grace, purchased for me, and if you are in Christ, for you, by the blood of Christ. A grace, Paul tells us, that God has lavished upon us. Amongst other ways, by making known to us the mystery of His will, according to His kind intention which He purposed in Himself, with a view to an administration of the fullness of time, which administration Paul describes as the summing up of all things in Christ, things in heaven and things in earth. What is this mystery of His will? Well, Paul uses this phrase later on in the same letter in chapter 3. In verse 4, he speaks of His insight into the mystery of Christ, which was in other generations not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to His holy apostles and prophets in the Spirit. And then he describes the mystery, that the Gentiles are fellow heirs and fellow members of the body and fellow partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. This is the mystery. And this mystery has to do with a purpose which God has kindly purposed in Himself to bring about an administration, an economy, an order of things in the fullness of times. And what is that? The summing up of all things in Christ, things in heaven and things on the earth. This summing up of all things in Christ was a major chord in Paul's gospel symphony. It is the reason for which he suffered most. We often say he suffered for preaching the gospel. Not quite correct. Paul suffered primarily for preaching the gospel to Gentiles as if they had an equal right to the gospel, and insisting that the gospel was the grand leveler, so that in Christ Jesus today there is neither male, female, bond or free, Jew or Gentile. We are in Christ by grace. And the church is to be an exemplification of this summing up of all things in Christ. And therefore, the grounds of our belonging to the church are and must overtly be grace and grace alone. The church must be a fellowship of grace in which we relate to one another not on the grounds of merit. Now, some Christians have a little less than merit than others, but all are our brothers and sisters. Paul would have had a much easier life, and we would have been all the poorer because we would have missed a lot of his letters, had he simply concluded early in his career, the simplest thing is let's love one another separately. You Jews over there, you Gentiles over there. But the thought never occurred to him. On the contrary. Almost in every single one of his letters, he argues for the unity of the Church of Jesus Christ and explains to Christians how to live together in spite of their differences. Let me for a moment take you to Galatians chapter 2. Peter is described there with regard to behavior in Antioch sometime earlier, when he taught no false doctrine, not verbally, but taught with a clarion voice by his behavior, by withdrawing from table fellowship with the Gentiles. What does Paul say? Paul says, first of all, that Peter was not walking according to the truth of the gospel. In other words, there was a fundamental contradiction between what the gospel is, a message of God's grace to unworthy, lost sinners, And yet, Peter was claiming that for Gentiles to be with him, like him, they need a kind of a cultural merit, or maybe a kind of a religious merit. They need to act as if they're Jews. They need to embrace some Jewish customs, if not all. And thereby he was walking contrary to the gospel, denying it. Indeed, towards the end of the chapter, Paul makes two statements. First he says, I, Peter, listen to me, in contrast to you, I, Paul, do not nullify the grace of God. That's what Peter was doing. He was saying that membership in the church, at least in our church, requires certain cultural merits. He was nullifying the grace of God. And then Paul concludes his argument to Peter with words that I find quite horrifying. He says that Peter is actually implying that Christ died in vain. That was Paul's vision. All things in heaven and on earth. And in heaven it'll be easier. It's pretty tough on earth. But all things gathered up in Christ. This is, once again, it's an aspect of holiness, is it not? The only reason why our differences cause conflict is because we take advantage of these differences to assert ourselves over against each other. Differences don't divide. Sin does. Differences don't divide. People do. Differences enrich. Differences challenge us at the very points where we need to be challenged, when our various cultures come together and our various viewpoints come together and conflict with one another and cause us, force us to rethink, to modify, to moderate, and to grow in Christ. Now I know it's common to seek for comfort, but I think we should be seeking for Christ. And that means that our church life should have this kind of expectation, the summing up of all things in Christ, male, female, bond free, Jew or Gentile. May God give us grace so to conduct our church life and our personal relationships.